From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. David Windsor is taking a much-deserved breather today. Now, each week we speak with experts about health, nutrition, lifestyle, and more. We speak with the best-selling national and global authors, with local experts who have a global influence, Pulitzer Prize winners, local authors, and sometimes just local folks who are living the mountain life in the most interesting of ways. Today, we'll take a look back at some of our favorite interviews of 2022, and we talk to a lot of people each year, about 125. We chose to air our previously broadcast interviews with Dr. Temple Grandin. She's an author, academic, activist, and animal behaviorist. Grandin is a prominent proponent for the humane treatment of livestock for slaughter and a very active proponent for the autism world. She discusses her book, Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. Then bestselling author Nathalia Holt, who has written a book about five female spies during and after World War II. Her book is Wise Gals, The Spies Who Built the CIA and Changed the Future of Espionage. Our guest is New York Times best-selling author Temple Grandin. She has been a pioneer in improving the welfare of farm animals, as well as an outspoken advocate for the autism community. Her new book is called Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. Temple Grandin, welcome to The Mountain Life.
It's absolutely great to be here.
Well, we are absolutely thrilled to be speaking with you. I just have to ask about your experience growing up with autism. I have to honor your mother because it seems like she was just a relentless advocate for really figuring out how you learn best, and you were as well.
Well, I was very lucky to get into a really good early educational program, speech therapy, learn language. Finally, learned to speak at age 4. Lots of emphasis on turn-taking games, where I learned how to wait and take turns at games. Really important. And then basic skills like getting dressed and, brushing your teeth, just your basic skills. And by 4, I was talking. Another thing that mother did is she always emphasized my interest in art. And I would just draw the same horse head over and over again. And she'd say, well, let's draw the horse is stable. Let's draw the entire horse. Let's use different media other than pencil. In other words, taking that interest and broadening it. Also, sometimes being in the 50s was an advantage. Manners were taught in a much more structured way. And we had sit-down meals. And let's say we'll just do a little demonstration. Let's say I stirred my drink with my finger. Instead of screaming no, mother would say, use the spoon. She'd give the instruction.
On the one hand, the fact that we are able now to diagnose autism much earlier, so that may be an upside, and then help those with autism or those on the spectrum at an earlier age. On the other hand, from what I've heard you say, it becomes this label, and we're sort of pigeonholing a lot of times those with autism, and we don't provide them the learning opportunities and the ability to find the way that they learn. Is that kind of what you believe?
I think there's some real problems. I'm seeing things where kids are not learning basic skills like shopping. Now, in my book, Visual Thinking, I talk about different kinds of thinking. And when I was young, when I first started working with cattle, I thought everybody thought in pictures the way I did. And then in my late 30s, I learned that was not true. But the other thing I found when I was working on the Visual Thinking book, I went through a whole lot of projects I'd worked on all around the U.S. with major meat companies. And I'm going to estimate that about 20% of the very skilled welders and metal fabricators who invented complicated machinery, drafting people laying out entire factories, that about 20% of these people were either autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD. And how did they get into these jobs? Well, they took a shop class in school, and sometimes a single welding class started their business. And some of these people have huge metal fabrication shops, and they're selling their equipment all over the country.
You talk
and
about,
now,
go ahead.
Now the kid is, they're getting addicted to video games, and they're not becoming video game designers. That's not happening. And we have a huge shortage of skilled people to make equipment now. It's a serious problem, and that's discussed in detail in Visual Thinking book.
I agree with you. I work in construction, and so I've heard you say that, you know, we need these welders, we need plumbers, we need electricians, because robots aren't going to come replace the water heater when it goes out. And so what do you think our educational system is doing to broach this problem, and how do you think it's going to look in the next 20 years?
I'm really concerned. We need to be putting all the hands-on classes back into the schools. You know, when I was in elementary school, I took art, I took wood shop, and I had sewing. And when I was in fourth grade, I had a wonderful little Singer Cell handy that actually sewed, and I made costumes for the school play with it. But taking out the hands-on classes, worst thing they did, all the shop classes. I was just up at Harvard University, and they have a makerspace in their physics lab with 3D printers. That stuff should be in the high schools. They even had crocheting and a sewing machine in this room labeled physics lab. I was there last night. And a lot of that equipment's not that expensive. That should be in high schools, because you've got to expose kids to interesting stuff. And the people that I worked with that built equipment for me would not have had those jobs if they hadn't had welding, or the other avenue was growing up working on cars. That was the other avenue.
In your HBO film, you talk, they portray that you know, you talk about having a, you want to have a life of substance and something, and do something with your life with meaning. And what point in your life did you realize that, you know, these patterns and these shapes and the way you were seeing things could create something that was bigger than yourself?
Well, I'm really getting interested in the different kinds of minds. And in my book, Visual Thinking, I discuss the scientific research behind different kinds of thinking. There's object visualizers like me who think in photorealistic pictures, and we absolutely cannot do algebra. And the people that had these metal shops couldn't do algebra either. Then you have the more mathematical pattern thinker. It's called visual spatial. And there you're a degreed engineer. Now, another interesting thing I did when I worked on the book is I went back to all the jobs where I'd spent a lot of time on the construction sites. And there's a very interesting division of labor on building something like a meatpacking plant from scratch. You have the object visualizers that make all the specialized equipment, often barely graduated from high school. The degreed engineers are doing boilers, refrigeration, snow loads on roofs. You see, this is where you need the different kinds of minds, and they have complementary skills. Now, in the first chapter of Visual Thinking, I talk about trips I did in 2019, and I realized we had a gigantic skill loss problem. I went to two pork processing plants, brand new ones, a poultry processing plant, and Steve Jobs Theater. And the poultry processing plant, all of the equipment that goes inside came over from Holland in 100 shipping containers. We're not making that equipment. Beef, we actually still know how to build, but the people are getting close to retirement now. But I was shocked when I went in this poultry plant that we didn't make any of the equipment. Then I went to the Steve Jobs Theater and the Apple Mothership building and found out that the structural glass walls were from Italy and Germany. And then as I researched for the book, I find out that the state-of-the-art electronic chip-making machine is from Holland. We invented it. The Dutch are building it. We have a problem, a big skill loss problem. And the kids that we need building this stuff, they're playing video games in the basement. And you know how you can get them off the video games? They're going to find that fixing cars is more interesting than video games. There's been five or six young adults. I wouldn't be critical if these kids were getting fabulous jobs in the computer industry. That's not happening. And we need these skills.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Temple Grandin. Her new book is Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. Temple, I've heard you talk about sometimes you saw solutions to problems. You saw designs in your head. You thought everyone must think that way. And then you found out, indeed, that is not true. And when you looked at the issue of Fukushima, for example, you thought, how could they not see that it was going to fail because of the proximity to water. Which aspects of design can you see a solution for, and how that comes to you?
Well, let's look at risk. Engineers, mathematical ones, calculate risk. I see risk. If Fukushima had had watertight doors, it would have been just fine. Because when the tsunami flooded it, the electrically driven emergency cooling pump no longer worked. Electric motors don't work underwater. I think most people know that. And what I learned is it's not stupidity. They don't see it. This is why you need the different kinds of minds working together. I can't design a nuclear reactor, but maybe I need to be working on the safety systems, because I can visualize how I can break. Now, right now in the Ukraine, the reactor got knocked offline and depends on diesel power. And I said, you better put good diesel in those generators. Don't put old rotten stuff that's sat in the tank too long. See, I'm already thinking about that, because they have that emergency cooling pump and it's got to run.
When you talk about those on the autism spectrum, no two people are alike. Some will be great mathematicians. Some will be visual thinkers like you. Can you talk about the different types of thinkers on the autism spectrum?
Well, the main difference, a lot of people are just mixtures of the different kinds of thinking. But you get someone who has autism, you may have an extreme object visualizer like me who can't do abstract math, but I'm really good at a lot of things. Or you might have an extreme mathematician, and you won't have both of those extremes in the same person. They're actually opposites. There's a whole chapter in visual thinking on the research object visualizers versus the more mathematical visual spatial. And then, of course, there's some on the autism spectrum that are extreme word thinker, and they often love history. They love facts. They have great memory. And I want to look at the kinds of jobs that different minds are good at. I'm good at art, mechanics, photography, and animals. The mathematicians, of course, computer programming, all kinds of mathematical sides of engineering. And again, exposure. Bill Gates and I got exposed to the exact same computer system. We had free time on it. I had to drop the class. He took off with it. You see, so he got exposed to the computer and he could do it. I tried playing musical instruments. I wasn't very good at that, but I was super good at drawing. And that skill was encouraged. We need to build on the strengths and expand them. Because I was just drawing the same horse's head over and over again. And mother says, well, let's draw the whole horse. Let's draw the stable. Taking it and expanding. You want to take the thing the kid's fixated on, expand it, and tap into that motivation. And I do a lot of talks to big corporations. And they ask me, what's the most important thing we should know? That different kinds of thinking exist. Because I didn't know that verbal thinking existed until I was in my late 30s.
It's funny, I'm kind of learning this too. I'm a very visual thinker, and I'm in construction, as I mentioned, and my business partner is a structural engineer. And so everything that we do in our jobs, for me, is color coordinated. So every single job has a color. And so when I look at the wall of a job, I can see that the red color is a specific job without even knowing anything more. And it wasn't until last week that my business partner pointed out to me, we don't think the same. I don't see the colors like you see them. And that was a thing for me. And so how can the visual thinking be crossed over, if at all, to other individuals like an engineer that doesn't see in that particular way?
Well, this is where you need to have both. Like when Betsy Lerner and I, she's my co-author, worked on the book, Visual Thinking. She's an extreme verbal thinker. We think completely differently, but we made a great complementary team, because I write the rough drafts. They'd be kind of associational, kind of disorganized, and Betsy would smooth everything out. You're going to have the same thing with your construction projects. You're going to have the parts where, you need the mathematician for the snow loads on the roof, but your kind of mind is going to be really good on the aesthetic parts of the building, because the engineers will just build a concrete box. And you need both kinds of minds. And what I'm really worried about is that the object visualizers like us are getting screened out. I don't know if I could graduate from high school today, because I can't do algebra. I've talked to a girl that wanted to go to veterinary school. She's on a third algebra course. She thinks she might be able to squeak by with a C as in Charlie.
Well, I think you could graduate high school just to say that. But You mentioned in one of your talks about the challenges that you had in that time, that it was almost more challenging to be a female than it was to be autistic. And
yes.
And you kept pushing the envelope in an industry that's so heavily male driven. And what gave you just the motivation to keep going to make sure that your design, you know, saw it through?
Well, when I was in my 20s, I had a very strong motivation to prove I wasn't stupid. It's a huge motivation. And being a woman was a much bigger barrier. I had to make myself extremely good at what I did. But I also saw doors to opportunity. There's a scene in the HBO movie where I go up and I get the editor's card because he was at a livestock event. And I realized if I wrote for that magazine, that would help my career. A lot of people don't see those doors to opportunity. And it was just luck that he was there. But I got the card and then I started writing for that magazine. And I think that helped because there were some women writing for the livestock press. So women were more accepted in livestock press. And I became livestock editor for that magazine. And that also was really helpful. Writing was an important part of my career too, along with the drawing.
You say that when it comes to learning and when it comes to showing what you have learned, oftentimes, it's hard to sell yourself through words. It's hard if you are not necessarily a good communicator to go to a job interview, for example.
And well, the thing is, I learned to sell my work and not myself. And one of the things I made sure is that some of my drawings got put in this book. What I learned to do was to show my work. I learned to sell my work. And when I've talked to big corporations, I've said, you've got to change your interview process. And some corporations are really like the idea of that. I had another one go, oh, we can't change that. Well, let's say you're hiring mechanics for airplanes. Your very best mechanic's not going to interview very well. Maybe you ought to have them bring in pictures of the car he rebuilt. That would be an example of showing the work. You see, the tech industry's been reaching out and letting, you know, the more mathematically inclined to come in and work on programming stuff. But you see, for my kind of thinker, mechanical jobs, somebody's got to fix airplanes. I can tell you something that I would be able to do. I could visualize the entire hydraulic system or wiring harness of an airplane. Now, I can't do that overnight, but over, you know, a period of time, I could learn that. So you get some little weird problem with the plane, I'm going, yeah, hydraulics probably leaking in this such and such. You see, and I would just see it.
Yes.
See, it's a different kind of thinking.
You know, in schools, at least probably was this way when you were in school, and it certainly was when I was in school, maybe David as well. You get to, you know, first grade or second grade, third grade, whatever it is, you're evaluated by your ability to read aloud to the teacher. That determines not only which reading group you go into, but a lot of the other topic subjects as well, math. And it's such an incomplete way of testing. And I'm sure that you've thought this through, how you see a new educational model, how we test for different types of thinking.
We need to, you know, I was good at art and I was given books on perspective drawing when I was a young child. Now, I couldn't read until age 8. And mother taught me with phonics, reading out loud. And within one semester, doing that for a few, you know, 4 afternoons a week, I went from no reading to 6th grade level reading. So you get into that debate. I was a phonics learner. Now there's some other kids that are different where they're a whole word learner. Also get a book that's interesting to read, a book that's worth reading. And we started with a book that was a 5th or 6th grade level book.
You're touring all these corporations, and I'm sure you're sitting down with some of the more brilliant minds in the world of business. And what is an underlying theme that you're seeing with these corporations? What are they missing in their, you know, we talked about the interview process, but just the overall structure and the way they operate their business. What are they missing? What are the components that they're not incorporating that they need to start doing?
Well, like, the first thing is they have to recognize that different kinds of thinkers exist and that they need these minds. I mean, let's say you're looking for airplane mechanics. Your regular HR departments, most of them are going to probably interview really badly. There needs to be a different way of doing the process. Like maybe you bring your kids in high school and have them work on mechanical things where they can show the skills off. The other thing I've found on, okay, the whole disability thing and big corporations, is the ones that have really successful programs have a manager in high places that wants to make it work. That is extremely important. So it's a real program and not just lip service. But I'm emphasizing we need these skills. We've got electric wires falling down in California. We've got water systems that are breaking, things that are just falling apart, a gas system that blew up in outside of Boston. And these are places where you need the visual thinkers. You see, we need all the different skills. Now, your more mathematical minds, they're going in your more traditional engineering programs, heavy on math, but you also need my kind of mind. You can't do higher math to go, hey, Fukushima should have had watertight doors. You see how basic that is? I can't design a nuclear reactor, but maybe I need to be working on its safety systems.
That's interesting. Yeah, we as a system collect the like-minded individuals to build the system, but we don't think about all the elements that go outside the system. What about the system of cattle that drew you in? I know on your aunt's farm that was a huge thing, but why did you fall so passionately into making this system work?
Well, I got exposed to it. This brings up a really important thing about careers. How can a kid that might be good at music get into music if they never got exposed to musical instruments? I got exposed to musical instruments and I never could learn how to play this little flute. Another kid will pick it up and play it. Exposure. Michelangelo dropped out of school at age 12, but he was exposed to great art and he was also exposed to stone cutting tools. You know, there'd be no David without stone cutting tools. You see, so what I'm worried about today is kids are just getting hung up on all the tech devices and they're not getting exposed to enough real things where they can go, oh, I'd like to do that for a career. You know, this is why all those hands-on classes are so important. Like in elementary school, we had theater. I was not interested in being a school play. I wanted to make scenery and costumes. And I made costumes on my Singer Sew Handy, real little toy sewing machine when I was in fourth grade. It was one of my favorite things.
You know, Temple, I'm thinking that your book it's good for all of us because for anyone who spends any time, a lot of time, like maybe our spouse or like David said, his business partner, you learn that everyone thinks differently and we have our strengths. Of course, your wonderful book is your target audience is maybe going to be those with different learning styles.
That's right. That's
of right. Any type, autism spectrum or not, right?
Or dyslexic. Michelangelo probably had autism. Einstein didn't speak until age 3. Elon Musk came out on Saturday Night Live that he was on the spectrum. We need these minds. Spielberg was dyslexic. I found the interview he did online, and he said that making movies saved him. But let's go back to exposure. He had a movie camera as a child. See, this gets back. Very important thing of exposure. Musk grew up with all kinds of shop stuff and engineering stuff around him. And they also traveled extensively. So he got exposed to all kinds of things and he learned how to work at an early age.
I often wonder, our labor shortage in just about any town right now, it makes me think like, where are all the high school kids? They're not working. What are they doing? And you say, you know, if you're sitting in your basement, playing video games all day, you're not getting the exposure, but there are joysticks in many different areas that you might find if you go out and just work and get that exposure.
Well,
right?
I'm now seeing the joysticks that are on the big excavating machines. You say, okay, that's an example of associative thinking. There's a lot of stuff out there that's more interesting than video games that actually has joystick connected to something real.
That's funny that you equate that because I was really good at video games and I love driving an excavator. So that's
so you're an excavator driver.
No, I'll hop in it every now and then. No, I'm on the management side of things, but I want to switch gears a little bit about and ask you about just the meat industry in general. I mean, we hear all these stipulations and things about it, and from someone that's been exposed to it so much, I mean, are things getting better? Are different systems being in place, or is it still just a really tough environment to be a part of?
Well, things have gotten a lot better. There are a lot of women in it now. Plants have animal welfare officers. I worked on equipment all through the 80s and early 90s. And then in the late 90s, I developed a very simple auditing program for assessing meat packing plants. And in 1999, I taught McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's how to use that, and it resulted in great improvement. I've got 5 journal article papers on this because you have to manage equipment. About half my clients back in the early 90s and the 80s tore up stuff and just wrecked things. You see, and then when you had a big customer coming in and forcing them to manage it, and I'm very proud of the fact that out of the 75 McDonald's suppliers, only 3 had to do a capital improvement. The rest of it was repairs and simple stuff like non-slip flooring, but management. Because what I find is people want the magic thing more than they want the management. You got to have the management to go along with whatever the thing is, whether it's a computer, a drug, what, doesn't matter what it is. You also have to have the management to go along with it. And the handling of cattle has gotten so much better. But now we're starting to get some issues with lameness. The cattle are very fat. And another thing that's come up is that I originally designed my center track restrainer system. And you can look that up on Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin and see how that works. You know, they'll maybe handle up to 1,600-pound animal. And now you got a bigger animal and it's got to be widened. Well, this is where people are retiring out. And we only have one big shop left. And they are gouging on the prices now to fix these things. Because the kids that should have been forming the little shops, starting the new little shops, they never got a chance to take welding class, or they never got a chance to do anything with building things. I'm seeing too many kids that learn how to build with Legos, but they never progress the tools. I'm seeing 16-year-olds that have never used a tool. I had a girl in my class last year who had never used a ruler to measure anything. We've got kids today totally removed from the world of the practical. So I've got a client right now getting really ripped off to fix the center track restrainer for fatter cattle. And I have to be vague because there's some confidentiality issues.
Wow. Temple Grandin, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. I hope everyone reads your book. It's Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was wonderful being here. Thank you.
Thank
you so much.
Our next guest is best-selling author Nathalia Holt. During World War II and the tense post-period of the 50s and 60s, 5 women employed by the U.S. government moved around the globe like shadows. No one except their immediate superiors knew the exact nature of their work. Even their families had no clue. But though they appeared to live ordinary lives as secretaries and clerks, their jobs were far more complex and exponentially more dangerous than anyone could imagine. Nathalia joins us this morning to preview her new book on the topic, Wise Gals, The Spies Who Built the CIA and Changed the Future of Espionage. Nathalia, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So how did you discover these women? And when you found out about this information and this incredible story, how long did it take you to compile all this and dive into the story?
So it took me about 5 years to really dig in and write this story. And I came across it in a really unusual way. It started in 2017 when I was interviewing a woman on a completely unrelated subject. And she had this very surprising story to share with me. And it involved a Nazi war criminal and this shadowy American woman whom I found nearly impossible to track down. And as I searched for her, as I tried to search for the people in the story that I'd heard, I just uncovered this network of American women who built the CIA after their service in World War II. And this was just so surprising to me. I was really shocked by this because while there have been so much written about women in World War II, and of course, many books written about men and intelligence, very little has been written about female intelligence officers, particularly during the Cold War. So, you know, as I was combing through all these CIA biographies and histories, I realized that even the names of these women had been omitted from history. And it wasn't just one, it was this group of women, and they were called the Wise Gals. And, you know, this was a name given to them by their male colleagues because of their sarcastic, biting humor. And they were stationed all over the globe.
So what does it entail when you get your hands on CIA documents and finding individuals that essentially didn't exist on paper for a long time? What is that like to compile all this information, and how's the process work with the government and uncovering and sharing classified documents, if you will?
So it starts with filing a Freedom of Information Act, which is what I did, and then working with the CIA to get all of the declassified documents possible for a book like this, which, as you can imagine, are many, many thousands. And then also going and digging into other archives. So I went through archives in England and in France and many here in the United States, and including, you know, smaller university archives that ended up having just all kinds of wealth of treasures. But there's so many details that you can only get when you talk to a person's family and friends. And, you know, sadly, the women that I write about in this book are no longer living. If they were living, I could never have written this book because their covers would probably still be classified and all of the operations they were part of would still be classified. But I was able to find their friends and family. And I also spoke with a large number of retired intelligence officers and some current intelligence officers that had worked with them. And so that was really how I was able to get so many personal details about what their lives were like, how it felt to be part of these operations. And then I was really fortunate through these family connections to be able to get some really personal moments clarified, you know, through diaries and photographs and letters, you know, things like that, that really make their stories what they are, really, really just sometimes heartbreaking and sometimes exciting, dangerous, but definitely inspiring.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Nathalia Holt. Her new book is called Wise Gals, The Spies Who Built the CIA and Changed the Future of Espionage. And Nat, this is not the first book that you've written about women in powerful positions. I think it's so great. It reminds me of that book that then became a best-selling film, Hidden Figures. It makes me wonder, in the research that you did, in a time that women really weren't valued in the workforce for, you know, more than being secretaries, how did it come to pass that these women were brought in to become spies?
So, you know, that's such a great question. And I love writing about women in history. And it's interesting to me, now that I've written several books about women in different industries, is to see how that happens, you know, how these women really kind of break free of stereotypes and manage to get these advanced positions. And in this case, it's really due in large part to a man named Bill Donovan, who is considered the father of American intelligence. He's the one that built the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, during World War II. And he saw a need for a diverse workforce in espionage. He understood that bringing in people of different backgrounds would really strengthen the spying the United States did during World War II. And so he brought in a ton of women, and as well as many other minorities, who was really interested in making this a powerful and strong workforce. And so it's really thanks to him then that you have these women who served in key roles as intelligence officers during World War II. And some of them were secretaries during that time as well. But then because of his openness, he was able to advance them into these other positions. And of course, that doesn't mean that it was easy for them. And I document quite a few of their struggles in this book about moments when they really have to take on the agency and fight for their standing and for their positions and, of course, for pay increases and even for the very nature of their work.
Well, let's talk about some of the women that you profile, starting with Eloise Page. She was what you say, an unexpected mix of conservative lady and technological wizard, which seems so funny because we, you know, at that time post World War II, we aren't really in a technological age, but maybe that this was something that Eloise was really interested in and good at.
Yes, that is definitely true. So, you know, we don't think of it, of course, as our modern computing age, although these women did play a big role in bringing modern computers to the CIA. But Eloise becomes the chief of scientific and technical operations. And she does that with a number of women in her department, and they're working on spy gear. So I talk about all these different devices that they make in the book that are very important during the Cold War, when there is this great need to be able to transmit documents securely. And of course, you know, there's no cell phones in everyone's pocket. So they make these little tiny micro dot cameras that are able to scan documents. And they make dead drop devices, which are basically just things that look like rocks or stakes, and they're able to put documents in them and then hide them into certain places so that they can be picked up by one person and left by another. And then one of the most interesting spy gear that I talk about in the book is this coded woman's compact. So basically just looks like any kind of old-fashioned woman's compact with, you know, which is basically just a circle that opens and has the mirror inside. But this one, when you hold it at a certain angle, it reveals a secret message. And so this was actually designed by another woman, Adelaide Hawkins, but under Eloise Page when she's head of scientific and technical operations. And this was just another way for the many women they had that were spying for the U.S. and that were working in espionage to be able to communicate. And so it's really interesting to see how during this period, when they're spying on the Soviets in this book, they're able to use all of these devices to be able to get information back to the United States. And this really ends up preventing war. What they find out and uncover during these operations has a profound effect in Washington and their ability to then not aggravate and make certain situations worse. And I go into a lot of detail about that in the book.
So to kind of follow up on Lynn's question about the background of them, are they already involved in the military and are they cherry picked from other departments, or do they have backgrounds in high academics and things like that? And are there common traits between all of them that made them a good team?
You know, what I love is that they're all so different. So, you know, there's some women like Adelaide Hawkins, who is a single mom of three. She has a high school education. She's from a small town in the South, and she is well aware that nobody expects anything from her. And yet she becomes this very powerful woman in the CIA. She becomes the chief of covert communications, and she has an important role to play in many different operations. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have Mary Hutchinson, who's an officer who has a PhD in archaeology. She's fluent in four languages. She serves in the military. And even with all of this, she at first is only offered a secretary job when she applies for the CIA. And she turns on the man who's interviewing her and says, quote, "That's a complete waste of my abilities." And, you know, that's how I just think it really underlines the point that it doesn't really matter necessarily what your background is. It really matters what they brought to these positions. So you can be someone like Adelaide Hawkins, who, you know, only had a high school diploma and yet managed to scrape by and work her way up, or someone like Mary Hutchinson, who, even though she had this PhD and was so well educated, still had to really fight to get her position in the CIA.
It's just truly incredible. Like Lynn said, I mean, I'm a sucker for these Hollywood type movies, and this is right up that alley with that. So when you say they changed the future of espionage for this country and everything, what was it that they did that impacted the effect the Wise Gals had on the intelligence world?
So in the 1950s, there is this really big event that happens, and it starts on, you know, kind of this foggy morning, February 1953, when Alan Dulles is sworn in as director of the CIA. And at first, nothing really startling happens. You know, Alan Dulles is merely standing in front of a crowd at the CIA during the ceremony. And he himself was not new to the CIA. He had served as deputy director, and so everybody expected him to be appointed. But what happened next was very surprising. And that's because as the ceremony comes to a close, Dulles asked, "Do you have any questions?" And immediately this group of women, the Wise Gals, just began peppering him with questions. And they asked, "Why are women hired at a lower grade than men? Do you think that women are given sufficient recognition in the CIA? As the new director of the CIA, are you going to do anything about the professional discrimination against women?" You can imagine, you know, even for a modern workplace, to have these kind of questions asked of a new agency director on the day of his swearing in would be, let's just say, bold. But in 1953, this was really unheard of. Nothing like this had happened before. And what happened from this moment is that the women formed what was mockingly called the Petticoat Panel. And this was a panel intent on gaining equity for female officers at the agency. And it is important to note here that women comprised a very large number of women of officers at the CIA at this time, about 39%, which was higher than the American workforce at total, which was about 30%. So already they were starting with a leg up, but despite that, they still weren't be given the promotions and pay raises they'd earned. So they started this panel, and it was just as much, though, about gaining more equity at the agency as it was about fighting for their type of work at the CIA, and that is espionage. And so what we see happening at that time is that when Dulles comes in as director, he immediately wants to downgrade espionage and rise up paramilitary and covert action at the CIA. And he says this very expressly to the people at the agency. And he also says, quote, "We have to face the fact that because espionage is relatively cheap, it will always seem inconsequential. What kind of impression can it make when I come along and ask for a few $100,000 and a bag of pennies?" And this was really how we saw these spying operations. They just didn't bring enough money to the CIA, and they didn't raise the profile of the CIA. So the Petticoat Panel is really a very complex time for the agency, because the women are fighting for themselves and for their advancement. They're fighting for the future of women at the CIA, but they're also fighting for really the soul of what the agency is about, espionage, what had always been the cornerstone of American intelligence, and trying to make sure that even though these operations didn't cost a lot of money, that they would be preserved. And what we see is that Dulles ends up pursuing these very controversial moments that really tarnished the agency's reputation in the years ahead. And this includes overthrow of governments in Iran and Guatemala, Project MK Ultra, the Bay of Pigs. And all of this ends up leading to Dulles's dismissal in 1961 by President Kennedy over his handling of Cuba. So it's really the women that end up getting the last laugh. And because they kept pursuing espionage and kept fighting for the role of their kind of work, they ended up being able to continue that. And what we're seeing is that even today, there is a resurgence in this kind of espionage, and the kind of work that the CIA is doing in Ukraine is very much based on the work that these women did building the first American spy network in Ukraine after World War II. So there's a lot of operations that I can talk about too that had these very profound effects on American history. But I think that you can see how keeping espionage as part of American intelligence really changed the future of the agency.
You know, it's interesting because of the very nature of the secrecy surrounding espionage. We as lay people, our experience of espionage is largely through James Bond or you know, whatever pop culture film we're seeing or spy novel that we're reading. We have this sense that espionage is very physical, you know, everything that James Bond performs during his day-to-day operation, you know, would be difficult for, especially at this time, for a woman that isn't a big brute, basically. So I'm wondering about the physicality of that, especially now, as you know, women are very strong and very able and capable, but maybe at that time it wasn't so prevalent.
You know, I think a lot of this comes down to the misrepresentation of what spies do that happens in Hollywood. Obviously, James Bond is not a real spy, and you can't really jump out of cars and airplanes and all of these things. And as much as I love those movies and as fun as they are, they do not represent the real world of what life is like for an officer in the CIA. there's so many different roles, of course. There's many different kinds of officers that play a role in all different kinds of operations. But I'll tell you a little bit about Elizabeth Sudmeyer to give you an idea of what it was like to be an officer in the CIA in the 1950s. Now, she served in World War II and then did junior officer training at the CIA before being stationed in Syria and then Iraq. And she spent most of her career in Baghdad. Now, when she was there, she did what is considered kind of the holy grail for CIA agents, and that is called a full cycle, where you recruit, develop, and handle your own agents. And she was able to do this in a way that really no other man could have done in the region, because the way that she recruited her agents was through a tailor shop and through a hair salon. And so she went into these places pretending to be just a regular housewife, or sometimes she pretended to be a teenager, sometimes she pretended to be a simple secretary of the government, and ended up making friends and then bringing these friends into her fold and learning more about them, learning about their husbands, learning about the kind of work they did. And through this, she then made these contacts and was able to form this huge network of spies. And she met these spies in movie theaters and in cafes, where they would secretly pass information to one another. And some of the information she was getting were technical plans about Soviet fighter jets. And this was really important at the time, because the United States was trying to create its own spy plane, which would then fly over the Soviet Union. And they had to know what they were up against. They didn't know how to build this plane if they didn't know who their adversary would be. And so Elizabeth Sudmeyer was able to steal all kinds of technical information on Soviet weaponry that made a huge difference in the course of the Cold War. And she did it through these small operations. She was also incredibly brave. So in 1958, Iraq experienced a coup. There was a revolution. The royal family was killed. And immediately, every American in the country was a target, and many were being killed as well. So every CIA officer in Baghdad left on that day in 1958, except for Elizabeth Sudmeyer. She stayed. She was the only one. And she did this because she wanted to protect their spies in the region. She wanted to protect the networks that she had built. And so at great personal risk, she managed to stay in the country, handle their spies, and keep transmitting information back to Washington. And that information was very important, because in Washington, you can imagine that once this revolution happened in Iraq, there was a real fear, and many of the advisors to President Eisenhower were telling him, send in troops, we need to get into Iraq. And it was largely thanks to a lot of the information being sent by Liz that that did not happen, and that war did not escalate further in the region. And it was because of this, actually, that Liz received the Intelligence Medal of Merit. And it wasn't, this is a very high-standing medal to get at the CIA. But as you can imagine, male administrators in Washington were very hesitant to give it to her. They said that a woman couldn't possibly have earned it. And it was really thanks to Liz's station chief, a man named Arthur Callahan, that she was able to receive this medal at all, and really mark this incredible sacrifice she made during that operation in Iraq.
That's fascinating. Wise gals, the spies who built the CIA and change the future of espionage is out. Nathalia, thank you for joining us on The Mountain Life. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.